Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for February 22nd. I'm Chloe from Drake University. Here is our first story. Bluffs fourth grader wins Symphony's Composition Competition by Tim Johnson. A Franklin Elementary School student has won a composition contest for young composer held by the Omaha Symphony. Fourth grader Kendra Jurek's piece, Thank You to All, will be premiered by the Symphony this spring during its virtual link-up concert for elementary students. The Symphony will record a video of the performance and send links to Council Bluffs Omaha Metropolitan Elementary Schools, according to Liz Kendrell Weinsner, the Symphony's Director of Education and Community Engagement. Kendra's composition was chosen from more than 200 entries, Weinsner said. Kendra wrote a great piece and she said, we had some good submissions. The competition is open to all grades, but fourth and fifth graders comprise the majority of the participating composers, Weinsner said. It usually attracts more than 300 entries. The winning composition was selected in three phases, she said. First, she went through the submissions to make sure they were playable by recorders and xylophones, which many schools use in elementary music classes. Then a group of musicians played them and chose some finalists. Finally, they passed them along to the conductor for this concert, Ernest Richardson, who selected the winner. The piece had been arranged for orchestra by John David Beasley, who added an introduction and interlude based on Kendra's melody, Weinsner said. The middle part of the arrangement features a selection with just her melody being played by recorders and a xylophone, which is repeated at the end. Schools are encouraged to have students play along with those sections when showing the video. We can't wait to perform with them in person again, when it's safe to do so, she said. Before the link to the concert is sent out, a musician from the symphony will make a virtual visit to participating schools to talk about music and a particular musical instrument, Weinsner said. Most people probably don't know that Kendra is a budding composer, but it's no secret that she's a music lover, according to Heidi Church, her music teacher at Franklin. Kendra really enjoys music, both performing and writing, she said. She is in both Franklin's after-school chorus and guitar clubs. Last year, the chorus got to sing at the Star-Spangled Banner at the Omaha Lancers hockey game, according to Kendra's mother, Tammy Jurek. Kirsch assigned students in music class to write a composition, and Kendra entered hers in the contest. I have noticed that Kendra is very purposeful and deliberate in her writing, the teacher said. Her piece, Thanks to You, has a sweet, smooth, gentle, and lyrical melody. The simple melody has five different notes in keeping with contest guidelines, which ask students to limit pitches to G, A, B, C, and D. So more students can successfully participate in this premiere, according to the symphony's website. One measure rhythm patterns were also provided, but Kendra chose her own rhythms. It took her 3 to 4 days to write the 12-measure work, Kirsch said. Kendra, aged 9, writes music outside of class too, and wrote lyrics over summer break, she said. The student listens to music at home and likes Ariana Grande and Gavin Magnus, a boy who posted his music videos on YouTube. She likes to sing along with Alicia Keys, recording of This Girl Is On Fire, some of Justin Bieber's songs, and A Million Dreams from the 2017 movie The Greatest Showman. Kendra used to sing with her late father and enjoys singing in church, where her grandpa sings and plays guitar for worship services, although the church is currently not operating, her mother said. She also likes to sing with her sister, Lillian, age 7, and the family's karaoke machine. When it's summer, they do take their music outside, Tammy Jurek said. Iowa Beef Council launches annual Best Burger Contest. Iowa Beef Council. Iowa Beef's producers are asking their fellow Iowans to help Iowa's Best Burger in 2021. In this year's quest, the Iowa Beef Industry Council and the Iowa Cattlemen's Association are encouraging the public to nominate their favorite burger, whether it's gourmet or down-home style. Burgers are such a classic American favorite and a great source of high-quality protein that is authentic, real, and raised responsibly. Beef suppliers 10 essential nutrients that support a healthy lifestyle without a long list of ingredients and no added sodium. It's hard to beat the nutrients you get from serving a real beef, and this contest showcases just that, said Kent Prusman, IBIC's chairman. This is the 12th year the groups are holding the annual Iowa's Best Burger Contest, which officially kicked off on February 15th. During the first phase of the contest, Iowans are encouraged to nominate their favorite burger before March 15th. At that point, the 10 restaurants with the most nominations will be visited by a secret panel of judges who will determine the ultimate winner. The 2021 Best Burger in Iowa will be announced on May 3rd, with the kickoff of May Beef Month in Iowa. The restaurant industry has seen some of the most notable changes caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, forcing many to close their doors indefinitely, said Stacy Klusner, Director of Marketing and Association Development for the Iowa Restaurant Association. This contest is not only a great way to celebrate the high-quality product that Iowa's beef farmers produce, but helps draw business to participating restaurants. Whether it be dine-in or carry-out, I challenge Iowans to rally their support behind restaurant owners and Iowa beef farmers by choosing to order a beef burger one additional time per week. To qualify to be named Iowa's Best Burger, the burger must be a 100% real beef patty and served on a bun or bread product. Details about the contest, rules, and the voting form are available on the Iowa Beef Industry Council website, iabeef.org. Burger lovers can also find a link to the online nomination form at the Iowa Beef Council Facebook page or by texting BEEF to 515-220-2020. Photos of your favorite burger can be shared socially using hashtag IABestBurger. The nomination period will close at 5 p.m. on March 15th. Restaurants can download a digital toolkit, including promotional materials for the contest from IBIC's website at iabeef.org, to promote the contest to their consumers. The promotional material can be used in the restaurants, online, or on social media. In 2020, Iowa's Best Burger Award went to the Twisted Tail in BB Town. Bill Would Alter Iowa's Bottle Bill by Rob Boschhart from Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Des Moines. A Senate subcommittee on Thursday advanced a bill that would allow grocery and convenience stores to opt out of accepting empty beverage containers that are now covered by Iowa's 1978 bottle deposit law. Under Senate File 368, retailers could refuse to accept beer, soft drink, liquor, and other nickel deposit containers effective July 1, 2022, if authorized redemption centers is located within 20 miles of their business. People would have to take their empty cans and bottles to those centers to reclaim their nickel deposits, as is the case at many stores now because of COVID-19 restrictions. The bill very intentionally makes simple but fundamental improvements in our current process, says Senator Ken Rosenboom, Republican Oskaloosa, the bill's sponsor who chaired a Senate Natural Resource and Environmental Subcommittee that advanced the measure by a 2-1 margin. Rosenboom said beer and liquor distributors now keep all the bottle deposit fees that are not redeemable, which has grown into a very large sum of money. He said the proposal legislation would have those deposits turned over to the State Department of Revenue, where the Alcoholic Beverage Division would distribute the money. No details were given about where the money would go. Lobbyist Bill Dix, representing Fairway Stores, and Brad Epperly, with the Iowa Grocery Industry Association, spoke in favor of the proposed changes, with Epperly saying grocers are not in the waste collection business and urging lawmakers to end the government-imposed mandate. However, Urbandale resident Jane Robinette said requiring consumers to make up a 40-mile round trip to a redemption center to recycle their cans and bottles raises so many obstacles. I just don't think it's that workable. She called for a more balanced approach that would raise the bottle and can deposit to 10 cents and cover more containers not now included under the law. Others worried Iowa would return to litter-strewn road ditches that preceded Iowa's bottle bill. Jess Mazur of the Sierra Club's Iowa chapter echoed Robinette's claim to expand provisions of the law and double the handling fee to 2 cents for redemption centers. He told subcommittee members that deposit law is wildly popular with Iowans, But some grocery stores and retailers are trying to use COVID-19 concerns as an excuse for not accepting cans and bottles they've sold, as the law requires. "We don't believe this is something that the grocery store actually wants because of COVID," she said. "They've been trying to repeal and gut the bottle bill for a long time, and if it really was about COVID, they would also not allow people to take their dry cleaning there or rent rug doctors from the grocery store. So I think it is just taking advantage of really horrible situation to continue to gut Iowa's bottle deposit law." Rosenboom challenged the premise the bill would gut Iowa's law, telling Mazur, "I don't think that's a fair assessment, given the bill is intended to allow various players time to build infrastructure and business models under the new provisions." After 9 years of seeing efforts to modernize the bottle bill fail, Rosenboom said he wanted to tweak the current law without ending it. He predicted provisions of the bill would lead to more business for redemption centers. "I think sometimes we get too cute by half in our attempts to modernize this program, die for a thousand cuts. We've all seen it happen," the Oskaloosa Republican told those attending via the subcommittee meeting via Zoom. Troy Willard, owner of the Can Shed in Cedar Rapids, said without an increase in the fee for redemption centers handling empty cans and bottles, "It is difficult for those businesses to be profitable, especially in rural areas." Willard said it takes about 25,000 containers to make one bale of aluminum that's worth $500, if you can get a whole truckload of it together. "I just don't see that being enough to add much incentive in these rural areas where you're not going to have somebody opening up a redemption center unless they're getting an extra handling fee or they've got designation agreements with retailers," he said. Family Incorporated strives to create healthy workplace for employees, wins award, by Emily Schlieb. Family Inc. of Council Bluffs was awarded $1,000 by the Iowa Healthy Estate Initiative for their efforts in creating a healthy and happy workplace. The organization created a wellness committee formed by members from the organization who create plans, activities, and create ideas to keep employees at Family Inc. healthy. "We want to keep our employees physically, mentally, and socially healthy, as well as having a good connection with others at work and participate in self-care," Executive Director of Family Inc. Kimberly Kolowoski said. "Since employees are currently working remotely, they have created a virtual acknowledgement jar. Through this jar, employees can send little positive notes like, 'Thanks for being positive today,' or 'Great job on that project,'" Kolowoski said. "When working remotely, people miss out on those informal social engagements where you go visit someone's desk or bump into someone in the hallway. Family Inc. has found a way to fill that gap with its family rooms. We created family rooms, and it's a time each week when there are open Zoom rooms that people can hop into and have those informal social engagements that we just don't have anymore," she said. "To focus on healthy eating, a cookbook was made with recipes submitted from employees. To incentivize submitted recipes, Family Inc. partnered with a local organization, the 721 Initiative. We partnered with the 721 and it did farmers markets bucks," Kolowoski said. "So our organization prepaid for some dollars that team members who submitted could get and earn by submitting recipes and then go to the farmer's market and spend those dollars. This promoted healthy eating because this gave employees access to fresh fruits and vegetables, as well as supporting other organizations in Council Bluffs. Other things the committee has done is having a water drinking challenge and given employees time to go out and vote. Another local area that won was Cass County for Healthy Hometown Award. Kolowoski said there isn't a plan right now on what to use the money for, but it will end up to the wellness committee. She continued to say that it'll be used to continue keeping all the workplace and healthy environment. "We are really proud to have this award," Kolowoski said. "We know our employees are our greatest asset, so it's our top priority to keep them healthy and well so they can be at their best to serve others. Quad City Democratic lawmakers blast Iowa GOP school elections and unemployment bills, by Tom Barton from the Quad City Times. Democratic state lawmakers representing the Iowa Quad Cities condemned legislation by the Republican-majority Iowa legislature they argue will erode support and funding for the state's public schools, elections, and the unemployed. The Davenport branches of the NAACP and League of United Latin American Citizens hosted a virtual forum Saturday with local state lawmakers to discuss legislation working its way through the Iowa Senate House. All Iowa State representatives and senators representing the Quad Cities were invited to attend. No Republicans chose to participate. Instead, local Republicans held separate events with constituents. Saturday morning in the LeClaire and Bluegrass. Saturday's public event was part of a series of scheduled forums with the local Iowa legislators hosted by a collection of local labor, civil rights, education, and other groups. State Senator Jim Lycum, Democrat of Davenport, and State Reps Cindy Wilkner, Democrat of Davenport, Phyllis Thede, Democrat of Bettendorf, and Monica Kurth, Democrat of Davenport, chased House and Senate Republicans for pushing extreme legislation this session they claim will make it harder for Iowans to vote, delay unemployment benefits for out-of-work Iowans during a pandemic, and erode funding for public K-12 education in favor of private schools. The Democratic state lawmakers took aim at a series of GOP-backed bills they claim undermine public education. Those include Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' school choice bill, which includes the creation of a private school voucher program and elimination of voluntary diversity plans in Iowa. The lawmakers said the legislation will weaken public schools by diverting taxpayer dollars from already underfunded public schools. Republicans contend the legislation would provide more educational options for Iowa students and families, particularly in schools that are underperforming. Education experts say the research on school voucher and educational savings accounts programs across the country has shown mixed results. We know we've got some problems with our public education system, but you don't tear it down like this, Lycum said. Davenport is one of five districts across the state with a diversity plan that allows districts to reject open enrollment applicants in order to maintain diversity in the student population. Elimination of that diversity plan would potentially finance a cycle that would lead to segregation of Iowa schools, said Davenport NAACP President Michael Guster. Allowing the wealthiest families to flee public schools for a less diverse charter or private school and reducing funds for poor and minority students, Guster said, this would take Iowa backwards. Thede and other lawmakers agreed. You're creating haves and have-nots, Thede said. You are creating a system where the wealthiest will have the best. State lawmakers this week passed a $36.5 million increase in state supplemental aid for Iowa's K-12 public school districts next year that is on its way to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk for her signature. Democrats oppose the bill because declining school enrollments resulting from parents keeping more than 6,000 young children home out of COVID-19 safety concerns means new funding levels won't cover about $71 million that will be needed when those children return this fall. The bill, Wilkner said, represents a $7.5 million cut to preschools. Under the bill, 137 Iowa school districts will receive less state funding than they did this year, meaning they will have to rely on a budget guarantee that supplements lower state aid with local property taxes in those districts, Wilkner said. They say more funding is coming, but we haven't seen it yet, she said. Lawmakers also took issue with Iowa GOP bills sponsored by State Senator Robbie Smith, Republican of Davenport, and Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican of Wilton, that would make sweeping changes to Iowa elections, claiming they would lead to voter suppression. The bill would make the state's early voting time frame one of the shortest in the country, constrain county election officials' ability to drop boxes for completed absentee ballots, and establish satellite early voting locations, creating stronger punishments for county election officiants that violate state law, and more. Smith and Kaufman have said that shortening early voting period is an attempt to prevent voters who, from casting an early vote they later regret, reduce the length of campaigns for weary voters, and shore up public confidence in Iowa elections after former President Donald Trump and his allies, absent in evidence, spread debunked and baseless claims casting the 2020 election as fraudulent. Curtin lawmakers also criticized a House bill that cleared a labor subcommittee that would make substantial changes in Iowa's unemployment insurance program. The changes would delay unemployment benefits for a week, making changes in eligibility for benefits, cut the number of dependents in an unemployed person's household, and change how unemployed workers are treated when their employer goes out of business. Kurth questioned the need for the change at a time when Iowa has the healthiest unemployment trust fund in the nation, and Governor Kim Reynolds pumped $490 million of federal CARES Act money into it to avoid any solvency issues. "We have plenty of unemployment funds. We are not in trouble," Kurth said. "This is nothing more than somehow a bill that is punishing working people who happen to be unemployed. Bad bill." Likeman and Thede called the bill more radical and mean-spirited legislation by State House Republicans. "I don't understand this mantra. I don't understand taking away and taking away and taking away," Thede said. "We have to divorce ourselves from all this bad legislation. They really are hurting the very fabric of the Iowa citizen. I don't know if they realize that. I don't know if they even care. But we can't keep hurting Iowa citizens. That is not good luck." Now on to opinions. Iowa Views: a silver lining of this pandemic, Iowans are connecting with health care providers. The following editorial appears in the Des Moines Register and appears here via the AP. Broadlands Medical Center in Des Moines recently received an unexpected accolation of COVID-19 vaccines. It quickly organized a weekend pop-up clinic, made appointments over the telephone, and got shots into the arms of more than 1,000 eligible Iowans, including seniors, child welfare workers, and teachers. "People were really happy to be here," said hospital spokesperson Katie Winger. Iowans who may not have previously visited Broadlands got a firsthand look at the dedicated staff and excellent care provided by Polk County's hospital. They will return for a second dose of vaccine in a few weeks and may choose to return later for other healthcare services provided there. Therein lies a silver lining of this pandemic. Iowans are connecting to healthcare providers. If you didn't have a physician or know your local pharmacist before, needing a vaccine may change that. We're reconnecting with family doctors, talking on the phone to nurses, and discovering the important work done by county health officials. And federal government is working to ensure more people have health insurance to pay for their care instead of working to dismantle the law that makes health care more affordable for millions of Americans. Ryan Freerich, head pharmacist and owner of Meyer Pharmacy in Waverly, administered about 400 initial doses of COVID-19 vaccine by early February. He is giving shots to his own eligible customers, as well as dentists, emergency responders, and other healthcare providers in an effort organized by the county. He said the additional work, which includes meetings, setting up online scheduling systems, numerous incoming calls, and figuring out the logistics of providing first doses to some while simultaneously delivering second booster doses to others, is worth the effort. "It's extremely rewarding as a health professional," he said. "You can just feel the relief people experience when they receive the shot. They are grateful. They will always remember these vaccinations." The pandemic is opening people's eyes to the fact that pharmacists are highly trained practitioners. Some of us are relying on them for shots that may save our lives. We are realizing they are easily accessible, have vast knowledge, and provide numerous other vaccinations. Many of us see our pharmacists more often than our family doctors. COVID-19 vaccinations are helping to forge healthcare relationships that will extend beyond the current crisis. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden is working to make sure health insurance is available for more people. Shortly after taking office, he signed an executive order directing the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to establish a special enrollment period for people to obtain coverage through exchanges created by the Affordable Care Act. The agency quickly announced a 3-month period that begins February 15th. Starting next week, Americans who need insurance, including those who have lost jobs, can visit healthcare.gov to find private coverage. Many will receive federal subsidies to help pay for it, and the lowest income people will be connected to Medicaid. After 4 long years, this country again has a president who understands the importance of health insurance to help cover the cost of hospitalizations, prescriptions, and mental health care. He knows insurance pays the doctors, hospitals, and pharmacists who have been there for us during this pandemic. We will need those providers going forward. This is what working to make America great for average people looks like. Bill to Constrain Absentee Voting Speeds Forward by Aaron Murphy of Lee Des Moines Bureau. A wide-reaching bill that would dramatically alter the shape of Iowa's elections could go from public introduction to state law in a little more than a week. Hey, who says the gears of government grind slowly? It's inspiring to know that state lawmakers are capable of acting swiftly when the spirit so moves. There are times when the needs are critical and rapid action is required by the legislator. This, unfortunately, is not one of those times. The elections bill would make many significant changes to Iowa's election system, which in 2020 produced the state's highest ever voter turnout. If the bill is passed into law, Iowa's early voting period would become one of the shortest in the country, and county election officials would have fewer options for expanding early and absentee voting. In other words, the very tools that helped produce Iowa's most successful elections would be significantly constrained or even eliminated. Republicans who have introduced the legislation are arguing their case that the changes are needed to ensure Iowa's elections remain safe and secure, and to ensure elections are operated the same across all of the state's 99 counties. That's an argument they should have to continue to make to Iowans for longer than a week. The legislation was introduced on Tuesday evening. Less than 24 hours later, it was passed out of subcommittees in both the House and Senate. It could be scheduled for floor debate this week, which means it could be on the governor's desk by the end of the week. These proposed changes are not nibbling around the edges. These would be, in many ways, reshape how Iowa elections are run. It's fine to present such a proposal, but the public deserves to have time to digest everything that's in the bill and provide feedback to their state house representatives, especially given the gravity of the legislation. A little more than a week is not sufficient time for the conversation that should be had over this kind of legislation. But with a bill like this, it would behoove state lawmakers to exercise some restraint, give the public time to learn about this proposal and provide feedback, or for against. That would be good governance, something legislators should always strive for, especially when it pertains to legislation like this. You're listening to Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for February 22nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Chloe from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this, or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Now on to obituaries. First, Zella M. Dutchman. Zella M. Dutchman, loving wife, mother, grandmother, and great-mother, great-grandmother, passed away on Friday the 29th of January 2021 at the age of 95. She was preceded in death by her husband, Glenn Duke Dutchman, parents Mary and Joseph Mathias, brothers Charles Mathias and Bud Mathias, and sisters Fern Lapsley and Mary Scott, Eileen Othmans, and Alita Kors. She is survived by her sister, Louis Beaver, in Chesterfield, Virginia, sons Dan Dutchman of Council Bluffs, Lauren Dutchman in Cedar Falls, Iowa, and Stanley Dutchman in Houston, Texas, and daughters Jan Riedick of Omaha, Nebraska, Bonita Richards of Sunrise Beach, Missouri, Glenda Cabot of Minneapolis, Minnesota, her German son, Hans Schlegel, of Houston, Texas, her grandchildren, John Riedick, Melinda Harris, Becky Dutchman, Aaron Lorenz, Brenna Dutchman, Kyle Dutchman, Bryce Dutchman, Allison Dutchman, Jeffrey Elgin, Chris Elgin, Natalie Simmons, and Daniel Kibbott, and her great-grandchildren, Abigail Summers, William James, Lucy, Charlotte, Will, Grace, Haley, Reagan, Isabel, Jeb, Joel, and Eloise. Zella was born in McClelland, Iowa, and graduated from Underwood High School in the 1942 class. She was a member of the McClelland Skating Club. She received the degrees of the Order of the Rainbow in 1943. Following her graduation from the Omaha Business School, she was employed at Fairmount Creamery in Omaha. She was a homemaker for several years prior to working at Thriftway Lumber Company. She was proud to call Lewis Township her home, and in 1971 began her employment with the Lewis Central School District as Activities Secretary. In 1995, she was elected to the Lewis Central School Board District 4. In 2017, she was inducted into the Lewis Central Educational Foundation Hall of Fame. She was happiest when she was home planting flowers and working in her yard. The entire family would like to thank the countless amazing extended families, neighbors, and friends for their underlying support through her life. She will be laid to rest next to her husband in Ridgewood Cemetery in Council Bluffs. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. at Hoy Kilinowski Funeral Home on Friday, February 26th. A family-only funeral service will be held at Hoy Kilinowski Funeral Home on Saturday, February 27th. But will be streamed for the public on the funeral home's website. Reverend James F. Kleffman. Reverend James F. Kleffman, aged 86, of Council Bluffs, passed away February 16, 2021, at Elmcrest Senior Living Center in Harlan, Iowa. Kleffman was born June 3, 1934, the youngest of 10 children on a farm near Portsmouth, Iowa, to the late John and Frances Kleffman. He graduated from St. Francis High School, Council Bluffs, in 1952. Kleffman spent his freshman year of college at Creighton University. Upon entering the Diocesan Seminary, he attended Laura's College, graduating with a BA in 1956. Kleffman attended Major Seminary at Mount St. Bernard Seminary and was ordained to the priesthood for the Diocese of Des Moines on June 5, 1960. His assignments from 1960 to 1968 included Atlantic, Erling, West Des Moines, and a teaching assignment at Dowling High School. In 1968, Kleffman entered the United States Army chaplaincy, serving at Fort Riley, Kansas, Tay Ninh, Vietnam, and Bremerhaven, Germany until 1972. Returning to civilian life, Kleffman served in Des Moines and Council Bluffs. In 1979, Kleffman returned to the Army chaplaincy and was assigned to Worms, Germany until 1982, when he was assigned to Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. until 1986. He was then assigned to Camp Humphreys in Korea for 1 year and then Fort Ord, California. He returned to civilian life in 1995, serving Missouri Valley, Red Oak, and Emergene until his retirement in 2003. In retirement, Kleffman served as needed in many Southwest Iowa parishes and with Catholic Relief Services. Most recently, Kleffman made his home in Harlan, Iowa. In addition to his parents, Kleffman was preceded in death by his siblings, Ralph, Harry, Walter, Charlotte, Alice, Harold, Norbert, and Richard. Kleffman is survived by his sister Marianne Schulner and her husband Leon of Dawson, Minnesota, and many nieces, nephews, and friends. Open visitation Sunday and Monday from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel in Council Bluffs. A private funeral mass will be held on Tuesday at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Portsmouth, Iowa, with burial following in St. Mary's Cemetery. Military honors will be tendered by the Portsmouth American Legion Post, number 547. Patricia Ann Vogt. Patricia Ann Vogt, age 82 years old, born on the late Howard and Mildred Hiverly on November 8, 1938, of Council Bluffs, and passed away on February 19, 2021, in Council Bluffs, preceded in death by husband Ronald R. Vogt, Sr., son Douglas A. Sales, grandson Tyler S. Sales, and brother Dennis Hively, survived by sons Dusty Sales, Danny Sales, Dwayne Sales, Daryl Sales, and Dwight Sales. Stepchildren Ronald Vogt Jr., Sherilyn Boynton, and Jerry Evans. Siblings Beverly Brown, Janice McNeil, Joyce Utterbach, Howard Hively, Nancy Montana, and James Hively. Nieces, nephews, and other loving family and friends. Services will be Tuesday at 11 at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Visitation is Monday from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Cutler O'Neill Funeral Homes. Memorials directed by the family. Dorothy Mae Palmer, January 3rd, 1924 to February 12th, 2021. Dorothy Mae Palmer, 97, passed away peacefully after a short illness on February 12th, 2021 in Mesa, Arizona. She was with her son and daughter-in-law. Dorothy was born in Atlantic, Iowa, January 3, 1924, and was later married to Marvin G. Palmer for 53 years until he passed in April of 2001. She is survived by her son, Corky Wayne Palmer, and his wife, Judy, grandson, Justin Palmer, and his wife, Cindy, and two great-grandchildren, Ashlyn and McKenna, all of Mesa, Arizona. Most of her adult life was spent in Council Bluffs, Iowa, except for a 20-year stay in the Missouri Valley, where she was the mayor for 2 years. Prior to that, she served as a justice of the peace in Lake Mawana. While living in Manawa, there was a terrible fire that killed two children. The fire department could not help because of restrictions on service areas. Dorothy decided that Lake Manawa needed a fire department, so she started fundraising, and with the help of many, managed to start the Lake Manawa Volunteer Fire Department in 1960. She left Iowa in 2016 and moved to Citrus Gardens in Mesa, Arizona, to be near her son and family. Funeral services Friday, 2 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Bayless Park Chapel. Interment Memorial Park Cemetery, followed by a gathering at Pizza King. In lieu of flowers, please make donations to local animal shelter. Stephen Frank DeVivo. Stephen Frank DeVivo, age 71, of Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, passed away on January 28, 2021. Steve was born November 27, 1949, to Frank and Doris DeVivo. He graduated from St. Albert High School in 1968. Steve is preceded in death by his father, Frank DeVivo, in 2012, and by his brother, John Michael DeVivo, in 2015. Steve is survived by wife Connie, son Nick DeVivo, and family daughter Krissa Martin, and family mother Doris DeVivo, sister Patricia Holder, and Nancy Schnitter. Steve has been cremated and no funeral is planned. Memorials may be offered to St. Albert Catholic School. Charlotte Spotto. Charlotte Spotto, aged 89, of Council Bluffs, passed away February 8th, 2021 at Chi Mercy Hospital. Charlotte was born September 28, 1931 in Council Bluffs to the late Thomas and Annie Spotto. She graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in 1951. After high school, Charlotte worked for the Council Bluffs bus transit system. Following employment at the Council Bluffs Savings Bank, she began her career with the Mercy Hospital in Charlotte. With the Mercy Hospitals, Charlotte spent 1 year at Bergen Mercy in Omaha, then transferred to Mercy Hospital in Council Bluffs, where she spent a total of 32 years doing office work in payables and payroll. She was a member of St. Peter's Catholic Church, St. Anne's Altar, and Rosemary Society and Catholic Daughters of the Americas, St. Anthony Court, number 330. In addition to her parents, Charlotte was preceded in death by her brothers Sebastian, Sam, Philip, and Joe. Charlotte is survived by nieces and nephews. Recitation of the Rosemary, led by the Catholic Daughters, will be held Friday at 9:30 a.m. at St. Peter's Catholic Church, followed by a visitation until 10:30 a.m., followed by a Mass of Christian burial. Interment will follow in St. Joseph Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to St. Peter's Catholic Church or St. Anne's Altar and Rosemary Society. Richard Jensen. Richard Jensen, age 80, passed away January 24, 2021. He was born January 2, 1941, to Elmer and Laverta Jensen in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Richard graduated in 1959 at Midden High School and married the love of his life, Judy Peterson, in 1963. The couple had three children and were married for 57 years. Richard served 4 years in the United States Air Force during Vietnam. He later became a member of the Post 437, the Minden American Legion. He also was an active member of the Minden Community Club, the Minden United Church of Christ, and was the sexton of Minden Township Cemetery, and in his earlier years, a member of Minden Voluntary Fire Department. He started working at Jensen Service in 1965 and eventually became owner and retired in 2004. Richard was a lifetime resident of Minden who helped out in any situation with a greeted smile and conversation. He enjoyed farming in his spare time for Lynn Olson and Ben Fisher, but most of all, he enjoyed yard work, tinkering with woodwork projects, reading, keeping his vehicle spotless, and spending time with his family and friends. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his sister-in-law, Marcia Russman. Richard is survived by his wife, daughters, Christy, Shelley, Handy, Jennifer, sister, Carol Doty, brother, Roger Jensen, six grandchildren, Kelsey, Connor, Cameron, Bryce, Chloe, Caden, great-grandson, Landon, brother-in-law, Jerry, nephew, Jeff, and a host of other family and friends. Memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Saturday, February 27, 2021. Visitation will be held the hour prior to the service. The family will direct memorials. Next, we're on to sports. State wrestling. Underwood's Barnes and Porter finished second. Riverside medals 2. McLaren wins 5th. By Austin Heenan. Des Moines. Underwood's Stevie Barnes and Gable Porter each finished their season as runner-up at this year's Iowa High School Wrestling State Tournament. Barnes lost an 11-5 decision to Lisbon's Cade Sheedbrick. The junior improved his placement from last season, where he placed 4th. "This is still a good feeling," Barnes said. "Obviously, it's not what I wanted. I wanted my hand raised at the end, but overall, it's been a good season, and I'm proud of where I ended up. We just have to get back into the training room and keep working hard every day. This means I have to put in a little more into it, and that there's areas where I can improve. Yet I'm looking forward to getting back at it and build off of this." Porter, who won last year's 106 title as a freshman, lost by a 6-2 decision. The sophomore, who started the year at 113, went up a total of 3 weight classes to 132. Not defending his state title hurts, but with 2 more years ahead of him, Porter looks to take it back next year. "Things didn't turn out how I would have liked, but I'll be back next year," Porter said. "This match is just going to push me to become better and stronger next year." Notably, Underwood's Easton LG, 2 of 285, lost his final match in the consolation bracket to Cody Fox of East Buchanan by pin, but still took home 8th place. Riverside ended the day with John Schroeder's. Coach Casey Conover would have liked to get more of their original 5 competing wrestlers on the podium, but is still more than happy to get these 2 medals and believes the future looks good. "State is always tough. Records don't matter here. Toughness is what wins here," Conover said. "This is nice, but we have to build on some things if we want to get higher up on the podium. We have to do more off-season stuff and commit to doing more," Conover continued. "We have more returning core next year," he said. "We will have 7 juniors in our lineup that we will transition to seniors next year. and we will need them to step up and be those leaders we need them to be to meet the high demands we have each year. I think we'll have a strong senior class, and we'll have a good junior high group coming in. From Schroeder, despite a lower finish than he wanted, he is happy to end his Riverside career with a win and a medal at state. I finished strong and battled back and just did what I needed to get here, Schroeder said. Last year, I wouldn't have made it to where I am now. My mindset just wasn't right. This year, I spent a lot of time training to get where I am now. It means a lot to end my time at Riverside with a medal. I worked hard to earn this, and I feel like I deserve to be where I am. And it shows today. For the first time since 2013, St. Albert saw one of their own on the podium as Falcom senior Kale McLaren, 1A of 170 weight class, earned fifth place after losing to Iowa City Regina's Aiden Udell by a 10-6 decision. Following that, McLaren claimed fifth after his 3-1 decision win over Dawson DeYoung, which was also a quarterfinal rematch. Feels amazing to earn fifth, McLaren said. Obviously, I wish I could have finished higher, but it feels good to bring a medal back to St. Albert. It also feels good to go out on a win here. After going 0-2 last year, I knew I had to come back stronger to get a medal, and that's why I went out and did. After losing his first match of the tournament, Glenwood's Matthew Beam, 2A of 120, battled back to claim seventh place to cap off his freshman season after beating Riley Anderson of Bondurant Farrar, who was responsible for Beam's opening round defeat. Seventh wasn't the plan, but it's better than eighth or not placing at all, Beam said. I had a tough match earlier and felt like I should have shot a third or fifth, but I got caught in a cradle, which happens, but I'm going to use that fuel to get back here next year and hopefully go get that championship. Prep boys basketball. AL finishes regular season with 61-57 win versus Millard West by Derek Noren, Omaha, Nebraska. Josh Dix scored a game-high 21 point to help Abraham Lincoln finish its regular season with a 61-57 victory at Millard West on Saturday. Christian Tidane was the other AL player in double figures with 11 points. Millard West was led by Evan Meyer-Sick's team high 19 points. Despite being outscored in each of the final three quarters, AL's dominant first quarter, in which they outscored the Wildcats 24-9, was enough for the eventual victory. AL is scheduled to begin its postseason at home on Friday in the second round of the Class 4A, Substate 1 bracket. The Lynx will play the play-in winner between Thomas Jefferson and Sioux City West. The game is scheduled to tip at 7 p.m. Running. Bluffs Track hosts Saturday race at Lake Manawa by Derek Noren. The Bluffs Track Club run took place on Saturday at Lake Manawa. Next up for the BTC is the annual CB 13-mile run on Saturday, March 6th. The event is the longest running race in the metro area and features 13-mile, 10-kilometer, and 2-mile options. The event begins at 10 a.m. with registration just prior to the race. Contact race director Mick Freeman at 712-328-3298 for more information. 4 for 4. Osaka wins Australian, stays perfect in slam final, from the Associated Press. As Naomi Osaka strode through the champions' walk leading to the court for the Australian Open final, headphones on her ears, racket bag strapped to her back, she reaches out to her left hand to tap a panel marked with her name and the year of her previous title there. Not a big deal, she explained, just a bit of superstition. Less than 10 minutes later, she began the match against Jennifer Brady. And less than an hour and a half later, Osaka won the last point. Because that's what she does when the stakes are the greatest. On her sport's biggest stage, Osaka improved to a 4-0 in Grand Slam finals by grabbing 6 consecutive games to pull away in what initially was a tight contest, beating Brady 6-4, 6-3 at Melbourne Park on Saturday. You don't go into a slam final wanting to be the runner-up. For me, I feel like every opportunity that I play a slam is an opportunity to win a slam, said 23-year-old Osaka, who will move up to number 2 in the WTA rankings. So I think maybe I put the pressure on myself too much, but honestly, it's working out in my favor right now. With serves that reach 122 miles an hour and produce six aces and returns that helped create six breaks, Osaka became the first woman to win her first four major finals since Monica Seles did 30 years ago. This is part of Osaka's 12-0 record in quarterfinals, semifinals, and finals at the majors. She plays so aggressive that she puts so much pressure on you to perform well, said Brady, a 25-year-old from Pennsylvania who played college tennis at UCLA and was participating in a slam final for the first time, and that's something not every tennis player has the ability to do. Osaka, the 2020 AP Final Athlete of the Year, is also on a 21-match winning streak that dates to last season and includes her championship at last year's U.S. Open. She also won the U.S. Open in 2018 and the Australian Open in 2019. What I have learned on and off the court is it is okay to not be sure about yourself. For me, I feel like I've always forced myself to be like, be strong or whatever. I think if you're not feeling okay, it's okay to not feel okay, Osaka said, but you have to sort of go within yourself and figure things out in a way. Osaka was born in Japan to a Japanese mother and Haitian father and moved to the United States with her family when she was three. She has been a vocal advocate for black victims of racism and police violence, saying she would refuse to play a match at one tournament last year to spotlight the issue. She's such an inspiration to all of us, and what she's doing for the game is amazing in getting the sport out there, said Brady, who was seated 22nd. I hope young girls at home are watching and inspired by what she's doing. Brady had to go through a hard quarantine for 15 days when she arrived in Australia in January because someone on her flight tested positive for COVID-19. Playing Osaka represented a big step up in competition during this tournament for Brady, who had not faced anyone ranked in the top 25, nor anyone previously appeared in so much as one Grand Slam semifinal. Brady's only previous final four appearances at a major came at the U.S. Open in September, when she lost to Osaka in three sets. She wasn't able to push the champ as much this time on an evening that was breezy and cooler than it's been lately, with the temperatures below 70 degrees Fahrenheit. The attendance was announced at 7,381. Spectators were allowed back after being barred earlier in the tournament during a COVID-19 lockdown. I didn't play my last slam with fans, Osaka said. So just to have this energy, it really means a lot. The final turned at 4-all when Brady used an on-the-run lob winner when she punctuated by waving her arms to request more noise from the crowd. That earned a break point. Convert that, and she would serve for the opening set. But Osaka erased the chance with a cross-court forehand winner, and two errors by Brady made it a 5-4. Osaka then broke to grab the set, helped by Brady's double fault and a netted forehand on a short ball to end it. Happens maybe 1 in 10 times, Brady said, of that mistake, or hopefully less. That was part of the run that put Osaka ahead 4-0 in the second set, and she was on her way. Now only two active women own more major trophies, Serena Williams with 23 and her sister Venus Williams with 7. Osaka beat Serena Williams, a player she calls her idol, in the semifinals Thursday. And as much as Osaka makes plain that she wants to keep adding to her Grand Slam collection, there are larger goals too. This is going to sound really odd, but hopefully I play long enough to play a girl that said I was once her favorite player or something, said Osaka, who signed autographs for fans after her victory. For me, I think that's the coolest thing that could ever happen to me. That's how the sport moves forward. And that brings us to the end of today's readings of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for February 22nd. The Nonpareil can be heard each day at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Chloe from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle, so it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.